Welcome to Majak Innovatsii, the podcast of Unit City dedicated to innovation from Ukraine to the world.
Welcome to Majak Innovatsii, and today we are going to discuss fascinating topics about medtech and artificial intelligence. We are going to think about, okay, what is medtech? What impact of the pandemic in medtech? Is Eastern Europe a good place, and why is it a good place, an exciting place to start a medtech company? But we will also ask way more important question. Are we going to live forever, or are we going to merge with robots soon? So stay tuned, because we are going to have all the answer with Daniel Semeray, who is the co-founder of the Health Venture Lab, a pan-European health tech accelerator based in Budapest and really close to Ukraine, and actually helping Ukrainian startup. So stay tuned. Let's talk about the future of health. Welcome to Majak Innovatsii.
Majak Innovatsii. 1, 2, 3, launch.
Daniel Semeray, good afternoon, good morning, good night, wherever you guys are. We are super happy to have you with us in Majak Innovatsii. And we are going to talk about healthcare and startup in the healthcare environment in Europe. You co-founded and you had the growth of Health Venture Lab, which is a pan-European healthcare accelerator and health tech accelerator. Tell us a little bit more about your story. What happened with you? Why health tech? It seems to be very specific. I mean, I'm a geeky guy. I love all sorts of tech, but health tech is really deep, right? How did you become passionate about this?
So first of all, thank you for having me on the show. I think it's a great honor to be part of such an interesting podcast. So what really led me here? I studied computational engineering. My bachelor's was in architecture, and I built more into AI. And when I co-founded a company that had very strong conversation with GE, because they had a lot of suppliers. And while we were in this conversation, it more and more cleared up that there's a huge opportunity in Europe to basically connect the healthcare institutions, be it academic or industrial players, and really create something unique that mines the talent in Europe to ride the wave of healthcare innovation, which is, you know, one of the biggest industries that's being disrupted now with technology, but also with policy and culture change. Basically, this idea formulated that the best way to do this is to find companies that are in a mature state, but still early stage. So they already have a company, a product that they're already selling, or they are currently expanding their first customer base, and help them basically get access to experts, be it healthcare marketing experts, be it the technical side, be it the sales side. And basically, through connecting these expertise to the startups, they get access without friction to knowledge that otherwise they wouldn't be able to get. And so there was an opportunity, and both on how we had, what kind of opportunities we had, and what kind of, and the second one is the growth of the healthcare market, which is and most of your listeners might be familiar with this, but you know, healthcare, not just through AI technology, but through more rapid prototyping, easier access to manufacturing tools, both on digital and hardware front, is being disrupted.
Actually, this is the first time we are talking about medtech on the podcast Majak Innovatsii. So what's going on in medtech, in health tech, in 2029, especially in COVID times? What are the trends?
Actually, what's very interesting for me is that healthcare was especially in the startup scene, was very untouched in some way by the pandemic. What it really accelerated is all these digital startups that were already there. They suddenly became important for the healthcare providers. So I would say they didn't really change, pivot into new areas because of the pandemic. But what happened is they got access to customers and they were able to sell much faster. So we had a company from Romania. They are doing X-ray with machine vision. So they help diagnose diseases for the doctors. For example, they were able to append their sales and collaborations by a factor of 20 during the year, because suddenly they mm-hmm. had access to, you know, there was also a pull from, for example, hospitals saying, yes, we need to digitize fast because otherwise we're out of capacity.
So you're based in Budapest, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. Right? Yeah. How is the region, the Eastern Europe, and I would like to include Ukraine in that actually, doing in the field? Is it a good place to do medtech? Is it a good place to start a startup? I mean, I know we have a great pool of talent, but when I think medtech, I usually think Boston, or that area of the US, or I think Germany, or I think, I mean, maybe France or maybe the UK. I don't necessarily think of Eastern Europe as being a good place for that. So what is your vision on that?
I think you've touched on a really good point. First of all, Health Venture Lab really aims to be pan-European. So we are not only mm-hmm. working for Eastern European companies. I think that's one thing that's special in us, is that we have a large coverage of Eastern Europe as well. So about half of each cohort comes from Western Europe, even Scandinavian countries. We had Danish, Swedish, Spanish. Actually, we had also French companies in our alumni, but we mine a lot of the talents that are in Romania, in Ukraine, in Serbia, also Hungary, obviously based, we are based here. But targeting your question, I think that's probably interesting. Is it a good place to start? I think especially yeah. for early stage healthcare companies, it's definitely an amazing place to do it, because and actually, a lot of large companies are seeking markets smaller markets like Eastern European markets. Individually, they are a very exciting place to develop, because you can find you can do it with pretty minimal risk. You're not endangering your entire market, but still there is high expertise, very high infrastructure, and a lot of talent. And so. I would say the only difficulty, I think, where Boston is currently, you know, maybe ahead of us, but we are, I think, very fast closing that gap, is later stage financing. So when you're looking for Series A, you get 10 times as much investment than a European company. So I think the opportunity is that for early stage companies, there is an abundance of capital here. Definitely, they are actually looking, like, really striving to find good ideas. So there's more money than ideas. There is more talent than startups. So a lot of them end up with corporates rather than doing their own innovation. And there is a large infrastructure, both in terms of university, but also in terms of like how advanced the healthcare systems are. So this is kind of...
So let me elaborate a little bit on that, because it's actually very interesting. And we don't see that only in medtech, but we see that in tech in general, that lack of funding for late stage. And we see actually, unfortunately, a lot of companies moving to the US, mostly to the US, to get their A and certainly B and later stage funding. How do we bridge that gap? What do we need to do to stop this or to change this?
You know, I think, first of all, there's already an advancement, I think, which is already kind of in the direction that this is going to be, we can accelerate this process. So it's going to be eventually solved by basically the dispersion of knowledge and technologies. Everything is getting cheaper. So it's not only Silicon Valley or Boston anymore where you can do startups. But I think you touched on a very important point, is that investment, the size of investment is still much larger in the US. And one of the reasons, I think, is just the natural risk awareness of, you know, the European cultures and the US culture. So how do you take risks throughout your career, not just financial investment risk, but just how do you think about taking risks is completely different. However, there's, I think, also just the maturity of it. So in Boston, they, you know, MIT and Harvard started investing in very, very risky biotech innovation in the 60s. So by the time that actually really matured, you know, they could ripe all that fundamental investment that they did early on. And it's the same with Israel. So everybody's looking to why are they so successful. They have started what Europe has started in the last 20 years. They have started in the 70s. So I think it's just maybe they are just a bit further ahead because they started earlier.
I would like to elaborate on a point you just mentioned, which is culture and the risk culture, because I think it's actually a very, very interesting point, especially when you're an entrepreneur. You're saying that we in Europe, which is assuming that there is something like a European culture, which is already something we could discuss, and we might in a second, but you're saying that we in Europe, we are more risk adverse than probably in Israel and the US, and that's kind of like slow us down in the process. Is that so?
I don't recall which report it was, but I think it was a very, even if it's anecdotal, because I cannot quote the report and that's where they quantified it. But anyway, what the report was about, they asked people, what do they think their success is based on? Is it based on their own choosing or like their own decisions, or is it based on the environment they are? And this was like a drastic difference between Europe, people asked in Europe and in the US. In Europe, most people said it's actually the circumstances, whereas in the US, most people said it's their decision. And I think this really touches on a fundamental aspect on what kind of, actually how we structure our government, right? European countries are much more socially aware because there is a combination of this, that you are thinking that this is actually outside your decision making. So let's help those people who you know cannot make a different decision. And in the US, like government is much smaller, especially than on like social welfare, because they think it's actually your decision if you become successful or not. So I think there is definitely a cultural aspect of this, but we are very much interested in deep tech companies, which means companies that are very research and development heavy. And so those companies, I think there's a really good culture in Europe for developing companies like this. We have across Europe amazing universities with long histories of actually bringing new technologies in these areas. And what we are seeing actually in Europe is not startups, or at least what we are interested in Europe is not startups like web type startups, where actually the biggest innovation is business model, value proposition, you know, maybe in some cases marketing. It's more, I would say, that you know, innovation projects become startups outside of the academia and outside of the company. So basically what usually a university does, if it's very practically cited, they can take it out into startups, and those become kind of deep tech startups with a very different funding model, with different risk and a very different risk profile.
And nowadays, how do you deal with startups? Do teams move to Budapest for your accelerator, or you work with them remotely?
We work with them remotely, not just because of the pandemic. The way we used to work when it was physical before the pandemic is that they had to fly in monthly to a very intensive sprint. And right now, because of the pandemic, everything is online.
Let's talk about Ukraine now. How do you see Ukraine like you have a good vision of several European countries. How do you see Ukraine in that map of innovation? I mean, are we behind? Are we catching up? Are we extremely good but catching up? Are we? Where do you see us?
You know, what I'm seeing, and obviously I never lived in the Ukraine, and I've met a lot of startups from the Ukraine, and I can see an overview of that. What I'm seeing is that the Ukraine is really fast digitizing, and I can see that a lot of people are moving into the, you know, digital economy by becoming pro coders, like say, like the influx of coders in the Ukraine. Maybe that's because of some of the political instability. That means, well, actually you can work to anywhere. And so I think this is a super good opportunity, because you are in some way, the circumstance makes a large portion of the the youth choose choose jobs that are probably growing in importance throughout the years. Mm-hmm. And this translates to startups, is that actually one of the key entry points is if you know how to code, it really helps in founding a company. So I think there's a huge potential for Ukrainian startups to really grow an ecosystem between themselves and with other European countries.
Lau, we'd like to go back or to go in your methodology. So, because I think it's also very interesting for us, because for example, in UnitCity, we have a few acceleration program. We strongly believe in acceleration. I see you work with in cohorts, so I guess you're hiring. So 2 points here: what are you looking for in a startup to get in your program? And that would be really the first aspect. How do you select those startups? So you told us they already have to have a product, probably already a bit of a team. So not super early stage, not just the ID, but already something. But then how do you choose them?
So number one, we have multiple programs, and I will talk about, I think maybe the question for you, the most interesting one. We have the Reactor Medical Imaging Program, mm-hmm. which is in the middle of the pipeline. So we also have programs for researchers, but also programs for growth stage company. But our core program, Reactor, the eligibility, you have to come from Europe. You have to be incorporated in a European country. So we only work with European companies. You have to have a product that you can actually sell. So maybe you've already sold it to one or two people. You don't have to have that. But what we really look for, apart from, is it an interesting product, is it an interesting business, is the motivation of the team. So okay. For an accelerator program, if you are uncoachable, or you're very much, if you think that you already know everything about business, then that's, then we're wasting each other's time. And we probably, maybe you're right, maybe you're not. But we really look for companies that are open-minded, because very often they meet actually not just the knowledge, but also the network. So even if they think they know everything about how to do a startup, what they don't have is an expanded network, the one that they might get through an acceleration program like ours. So, but really this is the core, they have to come from Europe, have to have an MVP, have to have a motivated team whose founders or key decision makers are willing to participate in the program, and who tackle healthcare products. And here, there is a bit of a focus. So we look for, primarily we look for medical imaging companies, but we also had we usually fill up about 60% with medical imaging companies and 40% with companies that we found otherwise very interesting, but are not necessarily fully in that focus. So for example, if you
bring go ahead. For example, I like the example.
For example, we had companies that help wounds. So that really is not about medical imaging. It's a hardware product to help wounds. We had companies that help the ovulation, tracking the ovulation of women so that they can become pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so there is a wide range. we look for companies that, for example, GE Healthcare experts can really accelerate, because that's a key component in our programs.
So, and I guess your partnership with GE Healthcare is explaining why you focus so much on medical imaging, right? Which is kind of the core expertise of GE Healthcare, if I understand correctly.
Yes, yes, you're completely right. It's one of the reasons. I think there's also a big opportunity in medical imaging that's currently being rushed to. So there's a lot of startups trying to tackle this space. And there's a lot of problems in healthcare that are medical imaging related. So both our expertise and the opportunity that's in the marketplace.
So as you know, probably or not, I don't know, but I live in Silicon Valley, but I lived for many years in Silicon Valley, and now I'm based in Ukraine. And we have those really interesting people in Silicon Valley who actually love healthcare, who work around the idea that we are never going to die one day, because technology is evolving so much that maybe actually the immortal person is maybe already born, and it's around the Singularity University and all those people. What is your vision on that? Is it part of your dream? Is it one of the things you guys are trying to achieve, like to find the startup that is going to make us immortal?
This is not one of our missions for sure, or at least it's not a primary mission of Health Venture Lab. So longevity, I think, although important, it really plays more on the elderly care on our side. So, by the way, we are backed not just by GE, but actually we were born under EIT Health, which is, you might know about them, is the European Union's body of, it's basically called European Institute of Innovation and Technology. And they have an EIT Health, basically an industry-focused part, that one of their focuses is helping, have a full life for the elderly. So I would say that's slightly on the range. So have like a useful, useful years in your old age, which is somewhat related to longevity. What my take on is, think about the body as a complex system of really thousands of parts, or millions or billions of parts. It depends on the abstraction that you go. Like, really have to have, as time goes on, the chance of something going wrong, and even if there is like a slight misdesign in the body or a slight misdesign in the system, with the time, the probability of something going wrong is growing really fast. So either you constantly help the person, or help this complex system which is the body, to heal or to rejuvenate, or it dies. So I don't think it's going to be, even if we achieve a state where humans are going to be immortal, it's not going to be by birth immortal. It's going to be by engineering throughout their years, by healing them, that they become immortal.
Millions of people dream to live forever, but have no clue how to spend Friday night.
It's a very nice way of putting that. Yes, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if the shortness of life is the problem. I think it's especially for, I would say, societies where people are already pretty well off, so they're not struggling to make an ends meet. I think the problem is not really necessarily the shortness of time, it's just how you use it. And I mean, this is a bit cliche, but but hey, I think it's true.
Personally, I have zero desire to live forever. I'm not looking forward to die. I hope this is going to be not painful and in a very long time, but I'm not looking forward to live forever because I think nature is not built like that. People die, and that's part of life, actually. I don't believe in life without dying, but that's just me. Other question for you. Are we going to merge with robots Because one of the way we could do it is, oh, my arm is weak, let's have a robotic arm, and oh, half of my brain is frozen, let's change it and put some chips in it, like Elon Musk would like to put chips in our brains, and all of a sudden we're merging with a machine. I heard Mark Andreessen and talking about investing in one of the issue we have is the medication we take is way too strong, and usually you kill the illness, but you kill tons of things with our nuclear pills, I call them, and so if we could find robotic pill that would just cure exactly the little thing we have, so are those things you see, and do you see European companies working on those questions?
So let me, I think that's a two-part question. Maybe less, I will start with the second one. So I think actually there is an easier step with medicine. So the problem is everybody is getting the same generic dose of medicine. And so personalized medicine is a huge field. I think anybody who's in healthcare have heard of this. I have met entrepreneurs who have actually exited their company, have a lot of money to do this, and they are doing it as a purely R&D project where they are still losing tens of thousands of euros with each patient that they are doing through. So I think it's definitely the future where you are personally, you get personalized doses of medicine. But I think it's still there are still a lot of problems until we actually get there. So the first part of your question, so are we going to merge with robots? I really hope so, actually. I'm a big fan of Link. They are first, like, everybody's scared of this. Well, okay, suddenly people will get into your brain. But what their pursuit is in the beginning is actually solve illnesses that maybe your spine was injured, or your center nervous system was somehow damaged, and help those people regain the ability of you know, motor control. So I think that's a really noble pursuit. I personally would be happy to be smarter. So if merging with robots is the way to do it, if I could become 20 times more intelligent. I would sign up for it.
And since actually you mentioned that at the beginning, you studied artificial intelligence. This is also one of your field. Is this your vision of artificial intelligence? Machine learning, whatever, making us smarter instead of working next to us or against us?
So I think first it's going to work with us, next to us, so not necessarily physically embedded in us. And maybe if things go well, I think it's a very hard problem to merge. And Neuralink, I think, still has a long way to go. I think that could be a next step. You know, AI against us, it's my problem is that the current state of AI, it really doesn't let me envision how final AGI is going to look. So I think there's a lot of the components out there. So there is machine learning for let's say like very core processing of images and words and you know, neurolinguistic processing. But then there's also symbolic AI, which is a more good old fashioned AI where you're actually trying to reason with logic. So all these parts, I think, constitute how the brain works. So the brain does process images in this very, you know, in parts of the brain and processes sound in parts of the brain. But then there is an abstraction on top of that, which is symbolic AI. So what I'm trying to get to is, you know, there are all these components there, but I still personally don't see how final AGI is going to look like and what kind of motivations it might have. Will it have emotions? Does it, for AGI, does it need to have emotions to become similarly intelligent to humans? Maybe, maybe not. And if they do, then they might turn against us. But in the current state, I would be hard pressed to tell you which direction it would go.
All those topics, I think, are fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I have two additional questions on that. Well, I have 200 additional questions on that. Actually, I have three. The first one is, how do you deal with ethics? Is it something when you look at a startup to join your program, are you looking at that? Are you looking at, okay, are those entrepreneur concerned? Is there a possible concern about this? Because this is a very tricky field that you're looking at, because at the end of the day, it's our human health.
Mm-hmm. We never had an application where we said, well, this is completely unethical, and probably most technical solutions will have both sides of the coin. I think, for example, I already brought up this ovulation period, company. So when they started this company, they were thinking about using this ovulation tracker for, as a means of contraceptive, so not getting pregnant, but there is some ethical problem because of what is the chances of this working perfectly and then getting a kid rather than looking to get pregnant, looking at the ovulation and trying to get pregnant. You know, there is less of a risk of an outcome. Maybe it doesn't work that well, but there is no downsides to it. So I think one thing that we do in the program is steer them into ethical directions if it's possible, if there are concerns. But most, like, I haven't met an entrepreneur who was ill-willed and who wanted to join our program. So all of them have very mission-driven, problem-driven view of their technology.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to Ukraine for a second, because Ukraine is really strong, actually, in artificial intelligence, machine learning. This is one of the things that we're starting to be well known for. Do you see any cool projects on that coming out from Ukraine? I mean, am I right when I'm saying that, and that is a field that Ukrainian startups should focus on, and maybe students should focus on more?
Yes, for sure. I think, there is this very interesting video by Jeff Bezos from 2006 or 2007 when he talks about the electricity metaphor, how he thinks the internet is like the electricity was in the early 20th century, where you still had to plug in electrical devices into where the bulb is. And he says the web, he said that in 2006, the web is kind of in that infancy where you're still plugging into the bulb rather than having this amazing infrastructure that we have now with electricity. And I think AI is very similar. So we are, although everybody's talking about AI, you know, it's a very sexy topic for startups, for every university has an AI part. I think we're very, very early in, and this was going to get just much more important. And given the digitization and the lead that Ukraine apparently has, I think it's definitely a good direction to be future-proof. And to be honest, AI is generally, even if AI is not going to be the next business for whatever reason that we cannot foretell, I think the pursuit of learning about artificial intelligence really touches on so many points on your own intelligence, on philosophy, on health, actually your physiology. So I think there are just so many parts of that. Even if you do something else, AI is a good basis for that.
Okay, I have a very basic question. What is your business model? I mean, because you're supported by very strong partners, GE Healthcare, EIT, and a few others. But how do you work with startup? I mean, do startup have to pay for the program? Do you take equity on the startup? But how does it work?
So we are a no equity, no fee start accelerator.
We? No, this is interesting because this is exactly the model of a Nest and the bootcamp we created during we don't take any equity, we don't take any fees. We just do it because we feel like this is our mission. And we want to build an ecosystem. And actually, I do see a lot of ecosystem topics on your website and on what you guys say. But however, keep going. Sorry.
Yes, we are. Then we are very much aligned in this pursuit. We are a nonprofit legally, but obviously it's a partnership between the European Union with EIT Health, G Healthcare, and we have four universities that we work with. The way there are a number of opportunities to generate revenue to finance our program. One of them is obviously the support of the partners, and one of the main system is actually financial support from the European Union. But there are other ways. So we have developed very strong connections to VCs who get opportunities in meeting a filtered set of startups, which really is super valuable for them. They are de-risking their investments upfront. They are also in some way outsourcing the search for good startups, and so there's a very strong collaboration with the VCs. We also have add-ons during our program, which we might not be able to finance because it's so resource intensive, which startups can purchase. But this is really just an add-on to the program that they can willingly choose or not.
What's next for you?
So we are developing the Catalyst program, which is a program that was developed at MIT by Martha Gray, Dr. Martha Gray, and been running for a number of years in Boston. And last year, through a number of European partners in Germany, in Spain, and in Hungary, we brought that methodology to Europe. Catalyst basically helps researchers create projects and research not into publications necessarily, but something into very directly translatable to the industry or to impact directly patients. And we really basically we finance both participants and faculty members who help these people help the researchers make that gap and understand how to build and how to research in a directed manner. So that's actually a very interesting project because there's also a large, long scale development of the project. It can go up until 7 years until some of the projects actually fully mature. So we're heavily developing that. We also created a program called Boston Deep Dive, which is for growth stage companies. And we want basically them to startups who have already established a presence in their own market but want to expand in the US, get more partners or customers, they can get access through us in the Boston ecosystem.
Oh, that's actually very interesting.
Yeah, looking again to Ukraine, so what kind of solutions are you looking for and you would like for Ukrainian startups to bring to your accelerator, to Europe? So what kind of ideas do you need?
I'm maybe repeating myself, but medical imaging. So for example, if you have developed an interesting algorithm that tackles a diagnostic problem, but we are also interested in hardware solutions in medical imaging. So it doesn't have to be necessarily just AI. But given how, the Ukraine is very, very strong in that, we are very much looking for big data and analysis for digital imaging, but there's another interesting part is if you have a startup that really tackles the efficiency of hospitals, so workflow optimization of hospitals and healthcare providers, that's also a very interesting area that I think has a huge impact because actually, just just a small thought. A lot of the problems in healthcare are not necessarily technological, but cultural and process oriented. So if you can bring an idea that really helps in changing the culture and changing the processes within hospitals or healthcare systems, that's a very exciting area to be in.
So now we are moving to our tradition. At the end of the show, each time we ask our guest to share with us favorite songs of the moment, because of his mood, because of what he's thinking. So Daniel, it's your turn.
So there are a number of ideas that come to mind. What I'm really listening to now is Circle on YouTube. I don't know if you know them. There is a Para for Cuba. There is a very nice set by it's called Para for Cuba, and the song is Sumidero.
Sumidero, Para for Cuba. This is how I'm going to finish my day. Paya for Cuba. I love it. Chill and a little bit vacation-y. Let's travel. Daniel Samurai, thank you so much. It was a fascinating conversation. I'm glad we have people like you to save the world or to help the world a healthier place. So keep going. I think we agreed on a few things. One of them is being immortal is not the goal, but merging with robots might be. I hope I'm not summarizing that too much, but it was great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And actually, I would love to have a conversation about your bootcamp and your
Please.
Project. It sounds like we're very much aligned.
Okay, and maybe we should we should work on a partnership or something. I would love that. So Tatiana will help us have a separate conversation on that.
I will.
Excellent.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Bye bye.
Listen to the song. It's very nice.